Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Earlier this week, President Obama announced a plan that's designed to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. The proposal has received mixed reviews in Congress. A number of Democrats are supporting it, but many Republicans are very critical of the agreement. Senator Patrick Leahy says he's optimistic that the plan will help reduce military tensions in the Middle East, and he challenged opponents of the agreement to come up with a better way to deal with Iran's nuclear program.
But the overall is a lot better than we were before. And the people who are criticizing it, let them snap and say, okay, how could you get something better? What would you do to get something better? Something short of war. We know how successful we've been having wars in the Middle East.
It's likely that Congress will vote on this agreement in September. Will Congressman Peter Welch vote in favor of this plan? That's one of the questions we have today for Representative Welch. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. It's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about this new agreement with Iran? Is it a good idea? What would have happened if there had been no agreement? Should Congress consider raising the federal gas tax to finance a long-term highway bill to fix up roads and bridges across the country? Do you support efforts to allow states to tax purchases on the internet? All sorts of interesting issues in Congress these days. Your thoughts? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net, or just give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Representative Welch, this negotiated settlement with the government of Iran does several things. It significantly reduces the stockpile of low-level enriched uranium. It makes huge reductions in the number of centrifuges that Iran has. It provides for international inspection teams to ensure that Iran is adhering to the terms of the deal. It lifts existing economic sanctions once the United Nations Security Council has approved the agreement. It provides a process to lift the arms and missile embargoes over the next 5 to 10 years, and it calls for the imposition of all these sanctions once again if Iran doesn't comply with all of the terms of the deal. Is this agreement the right approach for the United States to take?
Well, definitely it's the right approach to try to achieve a non-nuclear Iran through diplomacy and negotiations in an agreement, as opposed to the alternative that Senator Leahy mentioned of going to war yet again in the Middle East after the failures in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I've been a strong supporter of very, very tough sanctions against Iran. And the whole point of supporting those sanctions and ratcheting them up was to bring Iran to the table. Iran came to the table. And our partners, including Russia and China, who generally are not all that cooperative with us in international negotiations, came with us. And these exhaustive negotiations have resulted in an agreement that's complex. But you outlined what the provisions are. I'm in the process of reviewing that and getting briefed on it. Next week we'll have a security briefing. We'll have a classified briefing as well. But I want to be supportive of it. And from what I've seen, I can be supportive of it. And I think that there's three things in addition to the goal of a non-nuclear Iran. One is kick the tires on this agreement. And when Vice President Biden came in and spoke to our caucus, he wasn't exhorting us to do this for the Democrats or for President Obama. He was really encouraging everybody to ask hard questions about verification, about sanction relief and reimposition in the case of a violation. And I think that's the right way to go about this, because each of us has to come to an honest conclusion that this agreement will protect us from a nuclear Iran. But then secondly, there is going to be at a certain point a judgment that all of us have to make where we don't have the option of a perfect agreement. We have to make a decision as to whether this agreement increases our security and regional security, or do we go back to – it's not the status quo we go back to. What we would go back to is a situation where all of our allies have essentially affirmed this agreement and we're out there alone. So you really wouldn't have that sanction regime, and you'd have Iran unleashed to pursue nuclear ambitions. So I think that the judgment that we're all going to have to make is not what's perfect; it's what's best under the circumstances. And the third question that we really haven't discussed an awful lot, but I think is important for us to consider: if we have this agreement and it's enforceable and it's verifiable, what kind of dynamic does that establish with Iran? Does it help facilitate a new dynamic with a country that has been a real provocateur in the region that would help on the side of making it more stable and peaceful? And Iran is a split society. It's run by Islamic ayatollahs who are very fundamentalist in their approach, in the Revolutionary Guard, which is quite provocative. But it also has a population of about 80 million people. 97% of the people, 15 to 24, are educated, are literate. And, you know, in contrast to Saudi Arabia, with whom it has great enmity, not only can women drive, but 60% of the college students are women, 65% of the graduate students are women. So, you know, there's some potential that if we get to a stable situation with them, there would be internal dynamics unleashed that may be favorable.
Some of your colleagues think if you lift those economic sanctions that Iran is going to have a much stronger economy and be a much stronger player in that region, and that concerns them.
Well, that's right, and that's a fair question, and that's where I'm getting into this matter of exercising judgment on the balance of risk. You know, the worst-case scenario from their perspective is that there's $100 billion back in the economy. And by the way, the economy has really been crippled, so there is a strong case to be made that in order to stabilize the situation internally in Iran, they've got to put that money back into the economy. And of course, Rouhani, who was allowed to run by the supreme leader, made that essentially the major part of his campaign. So there's a real powerful argument that a lot of this money may be used for internal Iranian projects. On the other hand, we don't know. So those concerns that others have, I think, merit a careful scrutiny and monitoring. But again, if Iran acts adversely to our interest, then we are reserving our right to do whatever it is we believe is necessary to protect our national security or to work with our allies to do that. So this does not take options off the table for the U.S. or its allies.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. We've been discussing the agreement with Iran, the proposed agreement. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Lots of other issues to discuss that are happening down in Congress these days. Feel free to give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Linda in Enosburg Falls. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
You know, I love it. I love everything you do. I'm happy that you are inclined to support this agreement. I very much support it. One aspect you touched on is the good this will do for the people of Iran. We can't think always that we have to get everything and the other side should get nothing, and that will help. The economy of Iran is the life of its people. And if they've already taken a step by electing Rouhani, I think if the people themselves are living a better life, they will be able eventually to move their government toward a stance that we can get along with much better. So I'm all for a win-win here. We should have learned on the playground that my way or the highway is not a recipe for good relations.
Well, thank you for that.
Representative Welch, are you satisfied with the inspection and enforcement provisions of this deal? Because some of your colleagues are very worried about the inspection provisions.
Well, and rightly so. You know, this agreement is 80 pages. I'm in the process of reading it. It's very dense, and it has references to other documents. And the big question on inspections is basically put in simple language, anywhere, anytime, any place. And the inspection regime is not we can just say we'll show up and we'll get there 5 minutes later. And that would never be the case in an agreement, even with comprehensive inspection. So what I'm going to be looking at very, very carefully is what is the inspection regime to give me confidence that, in fact, if we have credible evidence that there is a violation, we're going to be able to get in there in a timely way to verify the situation. But the other thing with inspections is that there is going to be provisions – there are provisions in there, as I understand it, that have monitoring by a camera, by sensors, and by very sophisticated equipment that will give us real-time information. Obviously, this is a situation where we're not basing an agreement on trusting the Iranians. There has to be – specific provisions in there that allow for comprehensive inspections so that we can essentially distrust and verify. And those are the details that I think a lot of us are going to want to make certain are in there. The administration is assuring us that they are, and I've got to kick the tires and make sure that's the case.
Now, you visited the Middle East recently as part of a congressional fact-finding delegation. How do you respond to the severe criticism that Israel has made about this agreement?
Well, you know, sometimes with a friend, you disagree. You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very, very insistent from the beginning that this is a bad deal. And that was even before the negotiations were completed. Of course, he came and made his case to Congress. And you've got to take him seriously and Israel seriously. And they have an existential threat that they perceive with Iran, a nuclear Iran. So I take quite seriously the concerns of the prime minister and other Israeli politicians because, by the way, he's not alone. But on the other hand, there's a question here. Iran is a threat to Israel, but is Iran more a threat if it has a nuclear weapon than if it doesn't? And my view is that we're far better off, and Israel in the Middle East is far better off if Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. So then that gets us back to the question, are the provisions in this agreement verifiable so that we can have confidence that the Iranians, whether they want to or not, will be forced to abide by the terms of this agreement? So in the end of the day, I would say to Mr. Netanyahu and Israelis, we've got to make sure Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. And it's far better to do it by negotiation than by an act of war where there's going to be a retaliation by Iran if there's a military strike. And obviously, Israel would be in harm's way, as would American interest in the region.
So Congress is going to vote on this deal, it looks like, sometime in September. Do you think Congress will approve it?
No. In the way the procedure is going, it's a vote of disapproval. This is not a treaty that requires Senate confirmation, but under the agreement that the administration reached with Congress, there'll be a vote on whether we disapprove, and it'll be first taken up in the Senate and then in the House. And in fact, it's going to be a fierce debate. In the House, I think it's going to be very tough going for this agreement. My understanding is that there's not a single Republican vote in favor of it. And there's a number of Democrats who are indicating to me that they're going to vote against it. But the question will be whether we have enough votes in the House to sustain a presidential veto should there be a disapproval that's passed in the House or the Senate.
So what are the consequences of having that negative vote? How does that play out around the world?
I think it's extremely negative for the United States. I mean, first of all, we've got to remember something as a country. In foreign policy, we've got to do our best, I think, to try to have a unified approach. That's something that I say with some reservation because I think Congress has to disagree with the commander-in-chief or the president when he or she's making a bad decision like going to war in Iraq. But on the other hand, in a negotiation where it's clearly to the benefit of the world that we stop Iran from having a nuclear weapon, I think we should do our best to work with the president and have a unified front. The other thing is that in foreign policy and in national security, the United States sometimes should go it alone. If we believe that our national security interest is threatened, we've got to do whatever's required. But there's sometimes, in order to protect our national security, we should work with allies and build a coalition. And we've done that here. And this was an amazing coalition to get together. And one of the things that my colleagues oftentimes overlook is that this sanction regime, that did not hurt the United States because we have not, in effect, been trading with Iran since they seized the hostages in the embassy during the Carter administration. But all our allies, like in Europe, Russia, China, they had trading relationships that were put on hold for years because they were willing to work with us on the sanction regime. And they collectively, working with us, have come to this agreement where the goal of the sanctions, bring them to the table, bring Iranians to the table and get them to capitulate, has been achieved. So I think it would be very detrimental to our relationships with our allies if we stiffed them at this point.
Let's talk to Paul, who's calling from Bridport. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice to be talking with you and Peter.
Thank you.
My question is very simple. I'm wondering why Iran was not given the option or didn't decide to use thorium fuel instead of uranium technology for their new reactor.
You know, I have to confess, I have no idea. I just don't know. You know, as you know, a lot of the discussions in this and a lot of progress was made when Secretary Moniz, MIT-trained nuclear physicist, did the nuclear part of the discussions with a counterpart that he that also went to MIT, the Iranian counterpart. So I assume they may have talked about this, but I'm completely clueless as to the details of that.
Congressman Welch, I just want to get back to that House vote. Do you think there's a possibility that there are enough votes in the House to override a presidential veto?
I don't. And I think it would be very damaging if that happened. But I think that there's enough members that would uphold the agreement that the veto would be over, that the presidential veto would be upheld.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. We've been talking about the situation in Iran. When we come back, we're going to talk about the transportation fund, perhaps an internet sales tax, GMO labeling bills. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. With us today, Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you'd like to join the conversation here at Vermont Edition, or you can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Congressman, we did get this email from Dave, who writes us, I live in Connecticut, but I spent 18 years in Vermont. I'm very worried about H.R. 1599 that's being considered in the House. Could you please talk about this bill? I had to look up and see what H.R. 1599 is. It's the so-called Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015. Tell us about it.
Well, on memory, what that is this so-called country of origin kind of labeling. And I voted against it, but it did pass in the House. And it is it has some potential to be very restrictive on some of our local agricultural activities. And it's like big it's kind of a Bigfoot way of trying to get everybody to accommodate some of the concerns of the big food industry.
So that's not the bill that would prevent states from enacting their own labeling laws.
Well, you know, there's a couple. That's the GMO labeling bill, and if that's the Pompeo bill, I don't know the numbers on it, Bob. So if what we're talking about is the Pompeo bill, which is called the Dark Act, that prohibits states like Vermont and Connecticut and Maine to pass a law saying that if you have GMOs in your food, that has to be labeled, okay? I support the Vermont law. I oppose the Pompeo bill. And I think that what this is fundamentally about is not so much GMOs and whether they're safe or not. It's whether consumers who have an interest in knowing whether GMOs are in their food can be given that right to know by the labeling. And the industry has fought back fiercely on this. We saw in California where there was initiative that almost passed, was fought back with millions and millions of dollars that came in at the end. And I just don't get it, because I think that if consumers are indicating their preference, the market's going to adjust. And those who want to make GMO foods, they can make them. And then if I want to buy it, I can buy it or not buy it. So I think that this legislation that basically would prohibit states from acting to label is really, really disrespectful of consumers and rigging the game in favor of the big food industry.
We've gotten a couple of emails on the question of Bernie Sanders' presidential bid from John, from Betty, from Joyce. Essentially, they want to know, will you announce your support for Senator Sanders' presidential effort?
I haven't endorsed Bernie, and I haven't endorsed Hillary or anyone else. And let me tell you why. First of all, I'm pretty proud of both of those major candidates. You know, Bernie and I are friendly. I've talked with him on the plane. It's been amazing to see how powerful his message is being received. And I think that's an extraordinarily good thing. Hillary Clinton has got an incredible resume. She was in the Democratic caucus the other day. I don't know her like Senator Leahy does. I actually have never really met her, but she was much more relaxed and really focused on income inequality issues when she was there. The challenge for both of them is to make their case to the voters. And the voters are the ones who are deciding, and they're giving a real lift to Bernie, and I think it's having an impact on the Clinton campaign. A lot of folks want endorsements, but in fact, my appreciation for a strong campaign by Bernie and by Hillary is they know that at the end of the day, it's the voters, not the endorsers, who are going to make the decision. So both of them have to make the case. Bernie's been making a great case. We heard Professor Davis say what some of the challenges are down the road for him. Hillary's got some challenges as well. So I'm watching this, and I'm really much more excited about how Bernie and Hillary are working to get folks engaged, because we need an engaged Democratic electorate rather than political forces trying to ordain who's going to win this or lose it.
It certainly seems that Bernie Sanders is tapping into some message out there. He's drawing huge crowds in Nevada, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota. What do you think he's tapping into?
Very clearly, what he's tapping into is 25 years of wage stagnation. You know, we had this wicked recession, the worst since the Depression. And the reality is that Wall Street got bailed out, and that was done not so much for Wall Street, because Wall Street was sinking Main Street. But here we are 5 years later, and 7 years later, and the CEOs are doing fine, Wall Street's doing fine. But everyday people, a lot of folks lost their homes, folks lost their jobs, folks who have jobs oftentimes are having a job that pays less than what they had before that big recession, and folks who've been in long-term employment are seeing that they don't get raises. Some of that is because any potential raise goes to higher healthcare premiums. But what Bernie's, I think, tapping into is the reality that people are experiencing, and that is that, yeah, corporate profits are going up. The gross domestic product is going up, but wages aren't going up. And that's an economy that doesn't work. We've got to have growth and fairness in order to have growth. And Bernie's talking about that in a very blunt and very direct way.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Kevin in Williston. Hi, Kevin. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hello. I'd like to thank Congressman Welch for his great initiatives in getting legislation passed on energy efficiency, which is very difficult in the climate that we have in Washington. But what I'd like to talk about today is, do you take a carbon tax seriously? I think I'm a member of Citizens Climate Lobby, and we've come to speak to your staff many times, but I'd really like to know if you consider it a reality, because a revenue-neutral carbon tax where 100% of the proceeds go back to households is actually something that Congress could pass. It's not a tax per se, because it's all the money goes right back to households like Social Security checks. And I'd really like the like your opinion on it, and also like to know if you want like to speak to our members to get the details.
Well, I'd be glad to get the details, but I'm favorably inclined towards a carbon tax that does get the money back to people. so that it's neutral. But here's the benefit of it is that you put a price signal on the effects of carbon pollution. So you're supposed to just socialize those and have all of us pay for the expense associated with carbon pollution. So I think it does make sense. The prospects of passing it in this Congress are, I would say, zero. I mean, there's just no appetite for it. Now, ironically, some of the oil companies are a positive towards a properly designed carbon tax, but I don't see it as a likely policy option in the current Congress that we have.
Let's talk about the transportation fund. The House this week voted for, I think, the 35th extension to the Federal Highway Transportation Bill in just the last 6 years. The legislation extends funding for a variety of federal highway projects until December 1st, and House leaders say this will give them more time to work out a long-term plan. You voted against it. Why?
I'll tell you, I voted against it, and I'm glad I did. It is outrageous what Congress is failing to do. I mean, people complain about Congress, and I'll tell you, this is Exhibit 1. We have roads and bridges in every district in this country, Boehner's district, Pelosi's district, and my district right here in Vermont. And we just, yet again, passed a five-month extension. Now, how does the Agency of Transportation plan and fund a major bridge repair or bridge replacement on 5 months' funding? That's number one. Number two, the short-term funding this time is a joke. What we're going to pay for 5 months is going to be raised by charging airline passengers who go through TSA 10 years from now, literally 10 years from now. And I don't know how anybody with a straight face can seriously claim that we're doing something useful for our agencies of transportation or our infrastructure. So I've been on a protest on this, really fighting to have us get an opportunity to vote for long-term funding. And actually, we're making some progress. You know, when I first did this last May, I got 35 no votes. This time, we got 119 no votes, including 65 Republicans. And what is uniting us is not that we're opposed to the transportation bill. We're saying this is no way short-term funding to have a transportation bill, and we want an opportunity to vote on something that will provide secure long-term funding.
So if you want to have a long-term sustainable funding source, I think in the past you've said that you would support an increase in the federal gasoline tax. But that seems like a tough sell in this Congress. So what other options are there?
Well, there's a number of options. And let me just go through them. The gas tax is one. Unlikely that'll be brought up by Mr. Boehner. Corporate repatriation is another. You know, we've got $2 trillion in corporate profits that are parked abroad. And if they come back, there are a number of bills that Republicans and Democrats would support that would assign the revenues that we got to the Highway Trust Fund. That would be one time, but you could get revenues for 5 or 6 years, so you'd be able to get one long-term bill out of it. That's an example. There's another one where there would be a temporary – this is a Republican bill, a kind of a one-year gas tax that would be a bridge to looking at alternative ways to fund the Highway Trust Fund because we're getting into a situation now with higher mileage in electric vehicles. The gas tax has some limitations. But bottom line, going from pension smoothing, which is the way we paid for 9 months of funding where essentially we – put a pothole in somebody's future pension so that we could fix a pothole in their highway today. And then this absurd thing we just did by saying we're going to tax airline passengers 10 years from now, that's just irresponsible. And, you know, the thing that really bothers me about this is that we need to fix America. We've got to get our roads and bridges fixed, and we've got contractors, we've got workers who are ready to go in. They can do the work, they need the jobs, and we need this work to be done. And it's traditionally been an area where Republicans and Democrats get it. I mean, there's potholes in my districts, there's potholes in John Boehner's district. So we ought to get this done. And I've indicated to Speaker Boehner, look, I get it that it's tough on a revenue side, but I'll be there. I'll be your 218th vote. I want you to know that you put a revenue source on there, I'm ready to go.
So this week, Senate leaders said they want to pass a six-year, $275 billion plan that, unlike the House, they don't seem very interested in a short-term approach. So you've got a couple of weeks before the August recess. How does this all play out?
I'm not optimistic that's going to play out, because most of what I've seen when I look under the hood is a lack of revenue to actually pay for that. But it's positive that they're talking about this as a long-term plan, because that clearly is what America needs. By the way, you have a short-term plan on something where it's a long-term project, you end up costing the taxpayers more money. You know, if you let our transportation agencies plan with the security of secure funding, they're going to be able to get the job done for less money than if they have to lurch from 5-month extension to 2-month extension to 7-month extension. So, you know, fiscally, to be responsible, you've got to have long-term funding when you're committing to long-term capital projects.
I want to shift to dairy policy for just a moment. VPR Steve Zinn did a story recently that looked at what's happening with milk prices these days. In a word, prices are plummeting. Many farmers are really caught in a squeeze again. Now, Congress did pass legislation that I believe you supported that was supposed to help farmers in these situations, a type of price insurance they could buy that could protect them when prices went through the floor. But it turns out this program hasn't been much help at all for many farmers, because there's a very complicated formula that's used that compares grain prices to the cost of production. So what's going on here? Why isn't this program working the way it was advertised?
Well, there's from the Vermont perspective, the problem is that the cost side, our grain bills are higher. Our feed bills are higher than the overall formula. So, in fact, for this to be more effective for Vermont, it shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all on the cost side, where you basically take the cost of a feed across the country. You really have got to do it, I think, more on a regional basis, because our farmers do have higher feed costs than many other parts of the country. So that's the problem. What's happened in the price is, as you said, and as was reported, the milk price per hundredweight has gone down, but the costs have come down to some extent as well. So that difference between the cost and the payments to farmers has not shrunk enough for the program to kick in. And I think in Vermont, where it's been a problem for us with that formula, is that our feed costs, in fact, are higher than the national averaging suggests.
Can this legislation be changed?
Well, sure. It can always be changed. It's always a challenge. But I've been hearing exactly what was reported. So we're going to do what we can with our colleagues in the New England states to see if we can make adjustments. By the way, we were able to do that under the milk program before. There used to be no a cost part, component in the equation. And years ago, our grain prices went through the roof. So we were able to get that cost factor in there. Now it's a matter of, is the formula working or not? It's not. There's a recognition of cost, but not an inaccurate formula, I think, is a big problem.
We've got just a little bit of time left, but you've been a strong proponent of allowing states to impose a sales tax on items that consumers purchase on the internet. Currently, that's possible only if the online retailer, quote, has a physical presence in a state. So give us an update on this bill.
Well, this is very important. And by the way, it's not about, quote, imposing a tax. You know, under sales tax law in Vermont and any other state that has a sales tax, if you buy at a brick and mortar place, your tax is collected at that store. If you go on the internet, then theoretically you're supposed to pay a use tax. On a practical level, it never gets collected. So this is a tax fairness issue, that whether you buy on the internet or you buy in a brick and mortar store, that a tax would be collected. I'm working with Jason Chaffetz from Utah. We've got a new version of the bill, 38 sponsors. A lot of resistance from some on the Republican side, even though many Republican governors see this as a matter, as I do, of fairness. You know, if you have your downtown retailers, and retail is tough, having to collect this, and then somebody comes in, uses their iPhone, prices it, and then basically is able to avoid the sales tax, that's a huge competitive disadvantage.
We'll be following that, I'm sure, as the summer goes on. A lot of issues coming before Congress in the next few weeks. Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you. I always enjoy it.
And coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about the latest developments in the 2016 gubernatorial race. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The first campaign finance reports for the 2016 election were released this week, and they contain some big surprises. With us now to look at how the gubernatorial race is shaping up is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hi, Eric. Thanks for being on the program.
Good afternoon, Bob.
So, Eric, the big news from those financial reports is that one of the potential candidates in the Democratic field, former state senator Matt Dunn, has raised $134,000 in just 8 days. Dunn is a community affairs director at Google. About half of his money came from California. $134,000 is a lot of money this early in the race. What does it tell us about a possible Dunn campaign for governor?
Well, what it says to me, Bob, is that Dunn is very likely to announce that he is a candidate for governor sometime this fall. By announcing so early in the term that he would not be running for re-election, in effect, Governor Shumlin has accelerated the campaign cycle for everybody. So I suspect other candidates will begin fundraising in earnest, too, later this year.
Do you think Dunn is sending a signal to the other potential candidates that they're going to need a fair amount of money to compete with him in a Democratic primary?
I think so. Again, when we look back at the last time there was a competitive Democratic primary, which was in 2010, there were five candidates in that race. Governor Shumlin ended up winning it, and he spent several hundred thousand dollars, and I expect that's what is going to be required this time around to be a serious contender as well.
Now, two other possible Democratic gubernatorial candidates did not file a campaign finance report because they didn't raise or spend $500 at this point. One is House Speaker Shap Smith. He says he'll decide by the end of this month what he's going to do. Do you think Shap Smith will run for governor?
I think it's rather likely, although, as with everything Shap Smith does, he'll be very, very systematic and methodical about exploring the alternatives and talking to people around the state. He's spending a lot of time traveling around the state talking with key Democrats. And I think Shap is seriously interested in running for governor. He also wants to talk about the matter with his family. But I think it's rather likely that sometime later this summer or early in the fall, he will announce a gubernatorial campaign.
And if Shap Smith decides to run, what are some of the challenges that he'll be facing?
Well, he's well known in Montpelier, and he knows a lot about a wide range of policy issues that he's had to deal with as a speaker. I think his main challenge is the fact that he is speaker. Several speakers from both parties have tried to run for governor over the last several decades, but the last sitting speaker to be elected governor was way back in 1960. That was Ray Keezer, and he only served one term as governor before he was defeated by Philip Hoff. And I think that there's two constraints that a sitting speaker has running for governor. One is that the political skills needed to be a good legislative leader aren't necessarily those that translate into public appeal needed to win a competitive primary or general election. The other is the speaker is in many ways the public face of the legislature. And while individual members of the House and Senate tend to be generally well-liked by Vermonters, the legislature as an organization is not the most popular institution in the state. So Shap needs to overcome both of those hurdles in order to be a successful candidate for governor.
Another potential candidate is Transportation Secretary Sue Minter. What are the chances that she'll run for governor?
I think she's still seriously exploring and wants to look at a wide range of options. And in my view, Bob, if Sue Minter were to declare, I think she'd be a strong candidate. She has a lot of public managerial experience, which the state very much needs at this time. As Deputy Secretary of Transportation, Irene Chief Recovery Officer, and now Secretary of Transportation, she's worked a lot on intergovernmental issues with both federal officials and local government officials. So that's another thing that would work in her favor. She's never run statewide before, so is not all that well known outside of Montpelier or her old legislative constituency in Waterbury. Plus, she needs to develop policy positions on issues outside the transportation area, like healthcare and education. But I think if she were to declare, she'd be a strong candidate.
Now, if Sue Minter does decide to run, does she have to defend the policies of the Shumlin administration?
Not necessarily, because the areas in which she's worked, which have been sort of infrastructure policy, are not those that involve lots of partisan conflict, like healthcare in particular, and or that may be controversial at the local level, like education. So I think she can point to actually considerable accomplishments by the state in the area of infrastructure, recovering from Irene, getting roads reopened, making good progress on rebuilding the state office complex in Waterbury, and so forth.
Eric, do you see any other potential Democratic candidates at this point?
The only other name I've heard mentioned is Chuck Ross, who's agricultural official in the Shumlin administration, but before that spent a long time as Senator Patrick Leahy's state director.
So let's take a look at the Republican side of the gubernatorial race. Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott says he's seriously considering a run for governor. A lot of Republicans are putting pressure on Scott to run because they think he has a very good chance of winning. In the end, do you think he'll run?
I think he will. With an open governor's seat, this is a good opportunity for Phil Scott to make a run for the top office in the state. And even though it's a presidential year and Democratic candidates tend to do well in Vermont in presidential years, Phil Scott showed in the last two elections that he's very popular. And indeed, in 2012, the same election that Barack Obama won 67% of the vote in Vermont, Phil Scott got in the high 50% of the vote running for re-election as lieutenant governor. And that means about 40% of the people who voted for Obama for president 3 years ago also voted for Scott. So he's demonstrated a ticket-splitting appeal, which will help him next year.
Now, do you think it's likely that Dan Feliciano, who ran as a Libertarian candidate for governor in 2014, I think he got roughly 5% of the vote, do you think he'll jump into the Republican primary as well?
It's possible, because there are some conservative, real conservative Republicans who think Phil Scott is too moderate and that the Republican Party needs to present a clear difference on every issue imaginable and nominate a conservative. But even if Feliciano enters the race, I'd be surprised if Scott were not to emerge as the Republican nominee.
Eric, we've been talking about the likely Democratic and Republican candidates for governor. What about the progressives? Do you think they'll run a candidate for governor this year?
Well, the challenge the progressives face, Bob, is that if there is a progressive candidate for governor, the likely outcome of that decision to enter a candidate is A, the progressive finishes third, and B, that the Republican, whether it's Phil Scott or somebody else, has a better chance of winning, because the progressive candidate would divide the non-Republican vote with the eventual Democratic nominee. So I think progressives will think hard before they put up a candidate for governor. They may try and expand their representation in the legislature. If Phil Scott runs for governor, they may also look very seriously at what would be an open lieutenant governor's office.
And that would be a race that they feel they might be able to win.
They might be able to win, especially if there could be a fusion candidate, a candidate who could be listed on the ballot as both Democratic and progressive. Doug Hoffer, the state auditor, followed that strategy, and that's something that someone like State Senator Dave Zuckerman might think about for 2016.
And finally, Eric, those campaign finance reports that came out this week showed that a political newcomer, Brandon Riker of Marlboro, has raised over $100,000 for the race for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor. Virtually all of that money comes from Riker and members of his family. He's the managing director of his family's investment firm. What do you make of this situation?
Well, Mr. Riker is a man who's obviously made a lot of money at a young age in his family's investment business. The history in Vermont is that self-funded candidates don't necessarily do well. I think voters want to see someone who's accomplished something in public life before they vote for him or her. What complicates matters here, though, is that it's possible there could be a very large field in the Democratic lieutenant governor's primary. I've seen the names of four senators mentioned as possibly wanting to run. John Campbell, David Zuckerman, Phil Baruth, and Dick McCormick. So if you have a very large field, it's possible for a candidate to win the primary with only 15 to 20% of the vote. But clearly, Mr. Riker's going to have a lot of money to spend on political advertising and other forms of communication between now and the August 2016 primary.
It's going to be fascinating to see how it all shakes out. In just a few months, we'll have a much better idea how campaign 2016 is shaping up. Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's Vermont Edition for today. It's been 100 years since the last major log drive was held on the Connecticut River. Monday on the program, we'll look back at the men who conducted this rugged work and how they were able to move timber down the river. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.